That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek, and I am very happy to be joined once again by returning champion Alex Thurston. Alex is assistant professor of political science at the University of Cincinnati. He is a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute. He's the author of three books. His most recent one is Jihadists of North Africa and the Sahel, Local Politics and Rebel Groups. He has been a multiple-time returnee here to American Prestige, so I'm very happy to have him back. And we're going to talk about Niger, but Alex, thanks for coming back on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
So we're going to talk about Niger and maybe a little bit about what's going on in Chad, both of these countries having kicked out most or all of their U.S. military presence in the last few weeks. But I want to start, you've written two pieces on this. You wrote a piece in March called Why the Nigerian Junta Wants to Kick U.S. Troops Out. And then you wrote a piece just a few days ago on April 26th, Americans Go Home, Both Niger and Chad Yank the Welcome Mat. I should say we're recording this on May 2nd, just in case some big news happens before we release this. People will be forgiving of that. But in your earlier piece, which was the impetus for me wanting to have you come back on the show to discuss, you talk about your time when you your fellowship in 2013-2014 at the State Department. And it occurred to me that I've never asked you about this and all the times we've talked, you know, here and at foreign exchanges. I've never actually asked you about this experience, but you wrote something that was astonishing to me. I guess it shouldn't have been, but it was still astonishing to me. And I'm going to just read this and then we ask you to elaborate on it. You write, this episode, meaning the negotiations with Niger, which we'll get into later, has been a flashback to my year-long fellowship at the State Department in 2013-2014. During that time, one thing that shocked and dismayed me is that the Assistant Secretary of State as a position was implicitly considered within the State Department as a position equivalent in rank to an African head of state. I don't understand how that happens, but let's start with just what that means. Can you elaborate on what that means inside the State Department for that to be the case?
To start with that, obviously, like many State Department, you know, career State Department people would probably push back on that. But that was my own sense. I mean, I should say I was there, you know, I started in, I want to say, September 2013. So this is obviously, you know, Obama's second term. It was a time when, you know, Clinton had finished her time as Secretary of State and Kerry had come in. The Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs at that time was Linda Thomas Greenfield, who's now, you know, as you well know, you know, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. And it's been, you know, yeah, another flashback to that time has been seeing now the famous / infamous, you know, images of her with her, you know, her hand up to veto, you know, many different resolutions and so forth. And yeah, it's made me think about, you know, writing something about my time there and how. You know, the limited sense I got of how things work in DC from that year that I spent there. But yeah, to your question, I thought that, you know, I found it to be an extraordinarily hierarchical place, which of course makes sense. But and just that there was this kind of aura of power and deference that surrounded anybody from, you know, the ambassador level on up. You know, and so you have this hierarchy that I hadn't really been super familiar with before I started. But you know, you have the Secretary of State, the Deputy Secretary, you have all the undersecretaries, and then you have the Assistant Secretaries, Deputy Assistant Secretaries, ambassadors. You know, even the Deputy Assistant Secretaries, which were people who had often already been an ambassador somewhere, you know, were treated with tremendous deference and fear. You know, and a rebuke from somebody at that level could be, I think, very unpleasant for people. And, you know, so the Assistant Secretary, you know, in the Africa Bureau had, you know, really you know, along up and down the pyramid, I mean, dozens of people who were reporting to them, you know, and that position at the time, Thomas Greenfield, you know, is basically the person that the, you know, that all of the U.S. ambassadors to Africa were reporting to. So I think within the State Department, you know, this was seen as a, you know, a very, very high position. Obviously, somebody like that is going to be very, very busy. You know, and so, you know, there's a sense that their time cannot be wasted. And yeah, I did feel, you know, as I said in the piece, that within the department, within the Africa Bureau, at least, I can't speak for other bureaus, that there was a sense that this person was, again, implicitly, you know, equivalent in rank to, you know, to an African head of state. There was a time when I, you know, suggested, I think I can tell the story, I hope I can tell the story, you know, Nigeria had been her top priority, she had repeatedly said, which makes sense. Nigeria, you know, by many metrics, the most important country in Africa, most populous country, at least. She had talked a lot about, you know, the importance of the 2015 elections, which were at that time approaching. And there were a couple of off-cycle gubernatorial elections in 2014 in the southwest of the country. And I had suggested, this is one of the few sort of suggestions I made that got anywhere, that she call the candidates in the gubernatorial elections that year to urge sort of calm and so forth. And there were people within the you know, the State Department who pushed back and said, why is this worth her time to call, you know, state governors? And my thought was, state governors in Nigeria are more powerful than she is, right? That's a reach, actually, you know, for her to call them and expect them to listen to her. But it was seen within the department, at least among the people who pushed back, as a step down for her. You know, why should she talk to these lowly governors? I thought this was really, you know, a sign of how out of touch they were and how they projected the internal hierarchy of the department onto the world at large.
How does this manifest outside the department? Because I think this will get us into some of the possible insults that were committed in interactions with the Nigerian junta that may have led to the decision to expel the U.S. or to ask the U.S. To leave. How does it manifest in terms of interactions between people at state and, let's say, an African head of state? Is it a question of who gets sent to these countries and what the expectation is in terms of who they will meet with when they go there? Or what is the sort of manifestation in terms of diplomatic interactions?
Yeah, I think that the net result is that, you know, U.S. officials are often meeting with people who, in terms of, you know, protocol and hierarchy on their side, are three or four, you know, steps above them in the hierarchy. But then I think, you know, I don't think U.S. officials see those countries as peers. I mean, maybe this is different in other regions because, you know, I do think that Africa has a very low status, unfortunately, within the Bureau. I think even, you know, in sort of their mental map of the world, I think that they don't necessarily take, African countries all that seriously. But and then I think it, you know, from what I can tell, again, I'm sure the state folks would push back, but there seems to often be a very kind of imperious and lecturing tone, you know, vis-a-vis African leaders. And I think if you put that together, that what in any other, you know, in an, you know, African, you know, foreign ministry, somebody who would be considered a mid-ranking or sort of maybe mid to senior official coming and lecturing a head of state about, you know, in the case of Niger, you know, seeming to lecture them about Russia or lecture them about Iran or whatever. I think that lands really, really poorly. You know, I think people will take that sometimes because obviously there's a gap in resources. I mean, I'm thinking of, I was one of the people on the Nigeria desk when I was there, but I was also assigned Togo, which is a small country and doesn't, you know, take up that much, you know, bandwidth, I think, for state. But I remember the Togolese foreign minister came and, you know, and he had a, you know, a small detail with him. And you know, I think, you know, coming from a small and, you know, geopolitically, you know, marginal country, I mean, I think he was, you know, somebody like that, I think, knew what he was getting into and, you know, was willing to meet with, again, not, you know, he didn't necessarily always expect to meet with the deputy secretary or the secretary or something like that. I think people, you know, will sort of play along. But I think especially when you get a situation, you know, like Niger, where you have a, you know, a junta in power who's really willing to, you know, kick out the French and was clearly willing to kick out the US. I don't know that the diplomatic protocol issues were decisive, but I think that they didn't help.
That sort of leads me into my next question, which is, you know, what would be the response in your mind, or the differences in the way that, let's say, an established, quote unquote, civilian government, elected government, like the previous Nigerian government, that's sort of used to dealing with the U.S. in these terms, used to having assistant secretaries of state come and expect to meet with the president, that is, you know, includes trained diplomats. I mean, people, civilians, people who have done this for a living and kind of understand how to manage what is probably an insult in a diplomatic way, versus when you're now interacting with a military junta that's not versed in those kinds of dealings, doesn't have the same kind of sense of this is just how things are, and, you know, this is how we operate in the system. And, you know, probably feels like it needs to demonstrate some resolution or some kind of resistance to insult from a Western power to the public in Niger to kind of build its credibility. So what kinds of differences would you expect to see in those, you know, different governments and how they would react to something like this?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think especially the second part of your question is kind of my thinking about it, that they wanted to, you know, to show the Nigerian public that they weren't going to be pushed around. I think in some of the people in the junta, you know, have definitely been around the block, right? And you know, there were articles about particular, you know, members of the junta who had been very close to the, you know, US military establishment and so forth. And so I think they could have made a different choice, because I think they know how the game works. I mean, they could have kind of played along. But I think just the particular kind of collision of, you know, an imperious kind of, you know, visit, the Nigerians had said that they weren't even really consulted about the visit, that it was just sort of foisted upon them. And then you add in those sort of domestic incentives that you mentioned to, you know, to pose as the defenders of sovereignty and so forth. And yeah, I think they really didn't want to look, you know, like they could be pushed around by Washington. And I don't even think, I mean, I think even if Blinken had come or something, I think it might have gone the same way. But I think the protocol issues didn't help. Yeah.
Well, so let's talk about the substance, or at least what we know of the substance of this this visit that seems to have caused these grievances on the part of the Nigerians. What's been going on in Niger, which of course, you know, has been very important to the U.S. It's been a hub for counterterrorism operations in the Sahel. You know, we last talked to you around, you know, shortly after the coup in July. What's been going on since then in terms of Niger's orientation? We get this, you know, report, you know, the reporting is, you know, they kicked the French out. They're turning toward Russia, like Mali and I guess to a lesser extent, Burkina Faso, like those juntas have done. But what have you observed in the last few months in terms of what the junta is trying to do on a geopolitical stage and its interactions with these outside powers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, to some extent, I mean, there's some serious differences between Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger, but I think they all have some key commonalities at this point. I mean, the juntas all emphasize the idea of sovereignty. They all pose as, you know, very tough and militaristic against the jihadist insurgencies in their territory. And they also, you know, sort of see common ground with each other. They have what they call the Alliance of, you know, Sahel States, or the AES. There's talk about breaking with, you know, the CFA currency, the CFA franc. So I think, you know, they've all been kind of anti-French. They're channeling, you know, as you mentioned before, they're seeming to channel or to play to kind of popular sentiment. They're all open to various degrees to working with Russia. So you have, you know, the Wagner / I don't know, Africa Corps, whatever one wants to call it, you know, in Mali. But there's also been, you know, Russian quote unquote trainers and so forth in Niger. There's been recently some kind of murky and shaky reports about, you know, Niger and Iran and, you know, possible deals over uranium and things. I think that all should be treated with a great deal of caution, you know, until more details emerge. But they do seem to be exploring kinds of other, you know, partnerships as they turn against the West. Even Morocco too, you know, there was, you know, the Sahelian countries have explored a kind of a deal with Morocco to grant them, you know, as you know, I'm assuming many listeners would know as well, right? Mali, Niger, Burkina, Chad as well, all landlocked. So they've explored a deal with Morocco for a kind of Atlantic access. But yeah, I think that their main priority, all three of these juntas, is remaining in power. And I think they're willing to explore or cut whatever foreign relationships they see as, you know, helpful or harmful to that goal. I think that's a lot of what determines their geopolitical outlook at this point.
And I mean, this is sort of tangential in a sense, but we should probably talk about it. All three of these countries, you know, focusing on Niger, but this is also the case in Mali and Burkina Faso, all of them are supposed to be on some kind of path toward elections and the restoration of a civilian government, at least nominally civilian government. In all of these cases, as the coups took place, my assumption was that the juntas would eventually make that transition, but they do it in a way that left the military with, you know, either a veto or allowed the junta to basically recast itself as an elected government, and then they'd, you know, rig the election and continue on. But it seems like they've all stalled. And what's, you know, maybe, you know, we could focus on Niger, but does there seem to you to be any transition happening at all at this point?
No. And it's curious. I mean, I was thinking about this yesterday, and you know, something I've thought about on and off is why don't they just run one of their own as the candidate and then move forward on that basis? I mean, that's what's happening in Chad now, you know, on May 6th. In fact, there's going to be the presidential election in Chad, you know, basically a lock for Mohamed Deby, the, you know, the current transitional president and the son of the past president who was killed in 2021 in battle. In Mauritania, you know, in 2008, 2009, there was a coup in 2008, and then they ran one of their own, and that person, you know, was president for 10 years, and now one other of the coup makers from 2008 is president, very likely to be reelected in June of this year. So, you know, there would seem to be this clear model in the region, and I think it makes things easier geopolitically. You know, I think that even in Chad, where things have been egregious, I mean, there was an opposition, you know, candidate who was killed by the security forces in February of this year. I think once the dust settles from the Chadian elections, that a lot of countries will be willing to, including the U.S., will be willing to deal with Chad. Mauritania, you know, the coup of 2008 is long forgotten. In terms of why, you know, Mali and Burkina and Niger don't do that, I mean, I think with Niger, in part, it's because that's the most recent of the coups, right? So they've been in power for less than a year. Burkina, I think, you know, their argument has been, and Burkina in a lot of ways is facing the worst insecurity now. Burkina, you know, the argument has been that, you know, things are just simply too insecure. I think in Mali, it's almost the most curious because they've been there now for coming up on 4 years. They recently missed, I mean, they had postponed things, you know, multiple times, but they recently just flat out ignored the transition deadline. They've banned political parties. They've cracked down on, you know, civic associations. They've banned the National Student Association. I mean, they seem to prefer just a you know, very authoritarian, hardline kind of approach. I guess my theories would be one, or the possibilities, hypotheses would be one, that they just find, you know, overt military rule to be preferable. There's been, even at the symbolic level, a kind of hearkening back to military rulers from the past, including in some ahistorical and inaccurate ways. But so in Burkina, Traoré, the current military ruler, has portrayed himself as the kind of second coming of Thomas Sankara, the 1980s era, you know, revolutionary soldier, which is a comparison that, you know, virtually any critical observer, you know, sees as a big stretch. In Mali, they've hearkened back to Moussa Traoré, the leader who was in power from 1968 to 1991. I think maybe, so that's possibility one, that they just kind of, you know, actually find it politically preferable to just keep that aura of soldiers in charge rather than have any pretense. Another kind of hypothesis could be maybe there are internal power struggles within these juntas, particularly within Niger and Mali, that mean that they can't actually, they, maybe they don't have a consensus sort of candidate to run. I mean, those are the two possibilities that occur to me first. But yeah, I think it's weird. I mean, I think, and in fact, they seem sometimes to go out of their way to antagonize, you know, foreign partners, whereas they could have, or no, I don't even like the word partners, foreign countries, whereas they could get things back to normal if they wanted to diplomatically. I mean,
yeah, I mean, we can talk about this, but there's the U.S. has no problem working with, I mean, despite the rhetoric, has no problem working with a military government anywhere, really, but especially in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, if Assimi Goïta in Mali, or, you know, whoever from, you know, Chiani or whoever from the Nigerian side, you know, ran and won in an even minimally credible election, you know, a year or two later, I think the U.S. would return things back to normal. That's been the pattern elsewhere.
So let's talk about the specifically what happened in Niger. There was this trip, this delegation that went to Niger on March 12th and 13th. They wound up just inviting themselves, it sounds like, to stay for another day because they wanted to meet with Chani, and they were rejected, which I think is evidence for your theory that it was too low level a delegation for Chani to deign, you know, to sort of humble himself to meet with them. That seems reasonable to me, but it's led by the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, the commander of AFRICOM, which in itself reflects the fact that this relationship is fundamentally a security relationship, and there's not much depth to the U.S. tie with this country. But what do we know about that delegation and what happened? Because it seems clear, the correlation at least seems very clear, because it was just a couple of days after that trip ended that the Nigerian junta announced that it was tearing up its military cooperation agreement. So what do we know about what took place, or what's been discussed in terms of, you know, theorizing about what happened?
Yeah, I mean, from the press reports that I've seen, you know, it seems that the U.S. delegation was, you know, I was just reading an Al Jazeera article about this, you know, this sort of heavy-handed approach was the word that, you know, or the phrase that Yahya Ibrahim of International Crisis Group used, you know, just a sense that they came in. It sounds to me, maybe it was more complicated in the room, but it sounds to me like they were trying to present a sort of a binary choice between either you work with Russia or you work with us. And that seems to have landed really, really poorly. I mean, the junta complained publicly about the protocol issues, but it also seems that, you know, substantively trying to frame things in this sort of binary way, you know, didn't come across well. The other thing, I think I might have made this point in the first of the pieces that you mentioned, but, you know, AFRICOM's own rhetoric, you know, I don't know that Nigerian officials are sitting there reading, for example, AFRICOM's posture statements to Congress. But if they were, then, you know, those documents are very negative about the juntas, probably fairly, right? I mean, I'm no fan of the juntas, but, you know, very negative, and then very kind of zero sum about U.S., Russia, Chinese competition in Africa. You know, I think if I were the Nigerian junta reading those kinds of documents, you know, I would see the U.S. as you know, two-faced, right? Why denounce the junta to Congress and then come and beg the junta to let them stay? Or it's sort of, but I think even beg is maybe the wrong word, because I think there was a weird sort of combination of arrogance and pleading in the U.S. approach, you know, because the U.S. was clearly the one asking for something, right, and wanting something from the junta, but then also trying to phrase it as you know, threatening the junta.
Yeah, I mean, this gets into deeper issues, but maybe we could just go there now. There's a couple of things you write about the way that AFRICOM and really the U.S. you know, government as a whole talks about its relationships, not just with Niger, but across Africa, where again the orientation is almost entirely on this notion of security, or you know, if you want to expand it to great power competition, but there's very little on anything outside of what I would say is a basic kind of security framework. The framing seems to be like the U.S. military is operating in Africa as sort of the central player. And it's like the U.S. and its partners, its friends, whatever, fighting the bad guys, whether those are jihadists or, you know, the Russians or whomever. It doesn't really seem to be framed as a partner relationship or as, you know, enabling African states to kind of operate in the ways that they want to. It seems to be like the U.S. is the star. And these other countries, these African countries, are supporting players. And I have to assume that lands like a lead balloon, particularly with these junta governments, but just in general, this idea that the U.S. is the main player here.
Yeah, I think with Africa, too, there's you know, a sense that Africa only matters because of some, you know, external reason, right? That it only matters because of, you know, that the counterterrorism situation is you know, makes Africa important because affiliates of Al-Qaeda and ISIS are there, you know, or that Africa is a theater for competition between, you know, the U.S., Russia, and China. But Africa doesn't seem, in the rhetoric of U.S. officials, to have a kind of intrinsic importance. And I think then some of the, you know, I mean, I'm sure the you know, civilian folks in the administration would push back hard against that. But I think, you know, with the exception of a few programs that have really had kind of longevity, like the, you know, the PEPFAR program, which was a W. Bush initiative, actually, to combat, you know, or to help with HIV/AIDS. There's a couple long-running programs, but a lot of the other initiatives, you know, a lot of the Obama initiatives from you know, what I understand have been forgotten by this point. You know, and each president, especially each Democratic president, kind of rolls out, you know, different economic initiatives, but a lot of those don't really have much staying power. And I think what does remain constant in the rhetoric is this, you know, the counterterrorism and the great power competition. And I think the word, I mean, to go back to your question too, or another part of it, I mean, the word partner is thrown around so much. And I think some, you know, US officials probably do think, okay, this is a real partnership, we're working together. But to me, the word seems very euphemistic, you know, to say, oh, you're our partner. But we're going to dictate the terms of the relationship. That's not really, it's not really a partnership. I mean, something you said earlier too about civilian governments. I mean, I think even, you know, the difference between military and civilian governments and how that plays out. Even some of the civilian leaders, I think, get tired of this. I mean, I'm not remembering perfectly, but there was a trip. It might have even been Thomas Greenfield or some other senior official had gone to Uganda, which is not a country I follow closely, but Museveni, the president of Uganda, has been in power for a long time, you know, since 86, if memory serves, you know, key U.S. ally. And even he publicly was not willing to completely toe the U.S. line about Ukraine and Russia and so forth. So even the civilian partners, clients, if you want to say, of the U.S., you know, get tired, I think, of being told what to do and what to say.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at americanprestigepod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Getting back to Niger, what have you made of the response that the U.S. has? In the last couple of weeks, there's been this finally, it seems like, recognition that the junta is serious. They do want these military agreements ended. They want the U.S. forces out of the country, and you know, some acceptance of that. But prior to that, for a few weeks, there was this weird, like, dynamic where the junta had said, seemingly pretty unequivocally, we're tearing up these agreements, we want the U.S. out. But the response from the U.S. government, from the Pentagon in particular, but also from state, from the rest of the administration, was, well, we're not really sure what they're saying, and we're just trying to ask for more information, and, you know, we really want them to tell us what's wrong. And it's like, it just seemed very insulting and condescending to me, and just an obvious attempt to kind of drag things out, I guess in the hopes that somebody's mood would change, yeah, or somebody, you know, somebody in the junta would wake up one day and say, gosh, you know, we've been really unfair to the U.S. Let's go back to where we were, you know, before this all started. But have you been observing that, and what's been your takeaway in terms of not just the manner of the response, but how it's likely to be perceived among the people that the U.S. is presumably trying to communicate with?
Yeah, I mean, no, I really don't have actually much to add to what you said. I mean, I'm not somebody who cares a lot about, you know, U.S. prestige. I'm, you know, not somebody who thinks that these military deployments were a good idea in the first place. But I think if one did, if U.S. prestige was, you know, really important to somebody, then I guess I'm flashing to the title of the podcast now that wasn't intentional, but you know, that this would be a weird look. I mean, it looks desperate to me to keep trying to stay, as you say, to sort of hold out this hope that somebody would change their mind. I think it'd be stronger, you know, if one was really concerned with how the U.S. is perceived, it'd be stronger to say, okay, we're out. Let us know, you know, if you change your mind. I guess it's because, you know, of the you know, the assets. Everybody talks about the, you know, the drone base in Agadez. I think that a lot of, you know, U.S. officials and you know, U.S. government adjacent folks do seem to be convinced that, you know, that Niger was sort of the linchpin of U.S. counterterrorism efforts and so forth. To me, it's not clear that U.S. counterterrorism efforts ever achieved anything, you know, in the region. But I think there was a sense that, oh, things are going to get worse if the U.S., you know, pulls out. So, yeah, it really did seem desperate. In terms of, yeah, how it lands, I mean, I think that, you know, it's funny. I was right before the podcast, I was having a back and forth with somebody on Twitter who was raising good questions about how would you know Nigerian public opinion in the absence of reliable polling data and so forth, and especially with kind of, the person didn't say this, but we could add that, you know, there's been a lot of restrictions on freedom of the press and so forth. And but I think, you know, from the limited information we do have, it seems that the juntas in all three countries are popular, that, you know, that kicking out foreign forces is popular. So I think, you know, that the U.S. is not winning over the Nigerian public either with how it's approached this.
Yeah, you would think. I mean, it's hard to know outside the capitals in a lot of yes. these cases, right? Yeah. But you would think if there was opposition in these big urban centers to what the juntas are doing, that there would be some protest. Now, you know, granted, people may be afraid to do that because they, you know, the juntas would you know, react violently. But still, there's not even a hint of it. It seems to me that you know, I mean, there's been some protests, opposition. Organized protests about the stalled transition on a few occasions, but you don't see anybody like holding up signs like "Let the U.S. back in" or like "Let France back in." That doesn't seem to be a thing that anybody is particularly irritated with.
Yeah, and if somebody's a critic of the junta, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're pro U.S. or pro French or something like that. I mean, I think that And then in the conflict zones, I mean, maybe one could argue that, you know, the people in the conflict zones would be really ruining this, right? But I'm not sure that's the case according to the evidence I've seen. I'm not sure that, you know, people in the worst affected zones, you know, parts of Western Niger, Eastern Mali or something like that were necessarily saying, you know, we rely upon US surveillance or something, or we think that, you know, if the drone base is shut down, that things will get worse for us. I haven't seen evidence that people in the conflict zones are really dependent on the U.S. or France. Some serious protests were in, you know, against the French.
Right.
Were
right.
In conflict
there were
zones.
Protests
yeah.
in the other direction. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. One of the things that we've talked about in the past, and maybe, you know, we could just kind of continue to discuss this, is what is the U.S. actually want out of these countries? Like, what does it want in Africa? And does the U.S. you hinted at this in your pieces. It doesn't even seem like at this point, the U.S. government knows itself what it wants to get out of these places. Does it want democracy? Does it want stability? Does it want security? Does it want compliance? Does it want great allies in the struggle for the new Cold War against Russia and China? The reason I ask this is because what it's doing has gotten it nothing, none of those things.
Yeah.
There's no security. It's, if anything, the jihadist problem has gotten worse. There's no democracy. These hunters are taking over everywhere. There's no compliance. They're kicking the U.S. out. It just seems like, whatever this nebulous thing is that the U.S. wants, there's nothing to show for what it's doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm getting more and more cynical, but I feel like most of the talk about democracy is empty. I don't really think that the U.S. cares much about that. I think that it varies a bit from place to place. I think U.S. policymakers were probably, quite happy and probably behind the scenes were very involved in Senegal, for example, and not seeing Macky Sall, completely subvert the electoral calendar. I don't think the U.S. wants to see, things regress democratically in Senegal or in, Nigeria or something like that. But, if there was a military coup in Nigeria tomorrow, I'm sure that they would be very, very dismayed and upset by that. But I think that that has more to do with the U.S. preference for stability rather than a preference for democracy per se, because they've been happy to work with people who are overt, military leaders in the past or who are effectively military leaders. I mean, I was classifying Museveni earlier as a civilian, but you could argue that Museveni is still, a military, military dictator, Idriss Deby of Chad and, many, many others could be named who are effectively military rulers. So I think the preference is for stability. I think these open-ended kind of, counterterrorism deployments and so forth. I think, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say what's in people's, hearts. I don't necessarily think that, I don't think the U.S., for example, fosters instability or something. My own reading is that AFRICOM and state and so forth are actually deeply, deeply ideological places, right? And that somebody like the AFRICOM commander and, successive AFRICOM commanders, in my view, probably believes what they say. They come across actually as, to me, some of the most ideological people in the U.S. government, believing their own rhetoric about partnerships, about the U.S. being there to train people to fight better, to get back to, good governance. I mean, they have this whole kind of vocabulary that they use, and they seem, a lot of them seem to be, true believers in that. But a lot of the way the U.S. approaches things, to me, flies in the face of evidence, right? I mean, if, many, many people have pointed this out, the U.S. now has been effectively having the same approach in the Sahel since after 9/11, and the situation has gotten worse and worse, on the whole year after year. You would think it'd be time to change course, but it really takes something like this expulsion before they would do anything different. And I think there's a danger of them, just trying to sort of replicate some of the same approaches, but just in the coastal countries, in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, and especially.
Yeah, that seems to be where things are headed if they look for a replacement. But let's talk about that in a moment. Just how the U.S. might respond here. But I want to bring in the Russian dynamic. It's been different in, if we look at just the three Sahel countries, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. The relationship has been different. It's been much more intense, it seems, in Mali. Maybe is getting more intense in Niger, Burkina Faso, to some extent, but has sort of kept Russia, it seems like, more at arm's length. But what's the impetus? What does Russia offer these juntas? It's clearly not effectiveness in fighting jihadists, because I think there's enough evidence now in Mali in particular to show that's not helping in that regard. We sort of know what Russia wants. They want to sell weapons. They want, in the case of Wagner, when that was a going concern or whatever its remnants are, there's an extractive element. They get, control over mines and things of that nature. But what is the sort of like, what are the aims here on both sides in terms of kind of forming this relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple sort of hypotheses, and it goes back to almost like the previous answer, like how cynical versus ideological do you think people are? I do think a transactional relationship is at the heart of it. I think that, you know, juntas and other governments and factions in different parts of the continent have found it advantageous to work with Wagner/Afrika Korps, even as bodyguards and to sort of shore up their own kind of political survival. I think that's part of it. There's been a lot of talk about gold mining in Mali and how, you know, there's Wagner wants to have access to that, you know, and how that's something that the Malian authorities can use in transactions. I think it's also possible that there are kind of intra-junta dynamics and that the relationship with Russia can help, you know, boost the fortunes of particular junta members over others. And I think also, though, there may be a kind of an ideological element to it in that I think some of the militaries in the region, or at least the particular leaders who are in power now, do seem to me to feel that they can kill their way out of the jihadism problem. I mean, despite a mountain of evidence to the contrary. And I think some of them have felt, let us off the leash and we'll do what's necessary to kill the bad guys. And I think, you know, Russia and their approach plays into that. And it's pretty clear from the numbers, you know, you were alluding to this, that for example, going into central Mali in towns and just killing hundreds of people, that this inflames the conflict and doesn't make things worse. But I guess it seems to me that the junta doesn't necessarily accept that and maybe feels, okay, we're making a show of toughness and these Russian guys are really tough, so let's be tough together and we'll send a clear message. And I think, you know, they still seem to be caught in that mentality.
So I want to get back to where you think the U.S. might wind up here as it leaves Niger. There's talk of, you know, we've seen rhetoric out of officials in the State Department that, you know, they're not giving up on the dream of staying in Niger yet, despite the fact that they've, you know, agreed to withdraw. The argument is, well, we can still keep negotiating. And again, it's sort of this idea that these, fickle jihadist leaders who don't really know better will one day wake up and decide that they want the U.S. to stay after all. But failing that, the option seems to be moving drone base, you know, the drone base at Agadez, which was the big, you know, the big pearl here, but just moving sort of counterterrorism hubs to coastal states in West Africa. Do you see that as likely? Where do you think that might lead?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I don't follow those countries as closely as the Sahel countries. I mean, I think on the one hand, there's been a lot of attention in DC, you know, in relative terms. I mean, Africa doesn't necessarily get that much attention regardless, but in relative terms, I think there's been a lot of attention to those countries, you know, a lot of kind of reporting and analysis and so forth, you know, depicting kind of the tide of, you know, jihadism coming to those countries. And definitely there's been, you know, an uptick in attacks in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. But I think there's also been a little bit of a sense that some of the countries are more, you know, better positioned to manage things. I mean, there's been some sort of praise for Cote d'Ivoire and for their response to it. Maybe that would make the U.S., you know, a little bit less, you know, gung-ho about just completely replicating the strategy, you know, that they've had. But then, I don't know. Yeah, I think there will be the temptation to replicate the same strategy in those coastal countries. But if there's been any lessons learned, hopefully they would take a more kind of subtle and hands-off approach.
I do want to talk a little bit about Chad. You wrote about Chad in your April piece. In the last few days, it's seems clearer, and I've seen people write about this, that what's going on in Chad is a temporary thing. The Chadian junta asked the U.S. to remove its forces. There's about 100, I think, U.S. military personnel in Chad. The U.S. has agreed to redeploy most of them to Germany, but it seems more and more like they will be back after the election, and that this is a stunt by Mahamat Deby before the election to sort of show off his willingness to stand up to the West. He's doing so. He's using the U.S. basically as a foil, because unlike in Niger or Burkina Faso or Mali, the Debys like cannot, as unpopular as France is in Chad as well as everywhere else in this region, they're dependent on France. I mean, like they're beholden to France to some extent, right? Within their relationship. Mm. And so he feels like, this is the argument that I've seen anyway, that he feels like it's easier for him to use the US as a foil, not to touch the French, and just kind of, you know, after the election, he'll let the US back in. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic and just in general, what's going on in Chad and where you see things going with, you know, what sounds like basically just a restoration of the previous civilian government that's not really a civilian government. It's you know, military under a thin guise.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the analysis that you were saying about the kind of, you know, performative nature of them kicking out the U.S. And as you were saying, too, it's a, you know, it was a relatively small presence to begin with. I mean, not like the presence in Niger. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the elections are in just a couple of days. I think, you know, Mahamat Deby will win in the first round, you know, probably by some astronomical percentage. There was the leader, you know, who was killed in February, who I mentioned, the opposition candidate. Some of the other opposition candidates are, you know, I think very, very clearly co-opted, you know, so it's an election, you know, it's a multi-candidate election, but it's not a competitive election. I think after the dust settles, yeah, that you know, France and the US and so forth will accept the result. And then I think, you know, it'll be back to kind of, yeah, business as usual. I don't know that he would bring in US troops immediately. Right. I mean, maybe he would allow kind of a decent interval, but yeah, the relationship doesn't seem super strained to me. Not as, you know, as is the case in Niger.
So maybe just to sort of wrap up and, you know, this will be kind of getting back to some of the points that you've made throughout the interview. But if you were back at state in a position to advise the U.S. government how to manage relationships with, countries in Africa, especially, you know, countries.
No, I'm joking.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, I mean,
no,
yeah,
go ahead, hypothetically, go ahead.
Let's say we had a, you know, something miraculous happened, and the U.S. government decided to get its head out of its rear end. But what would you advise in dealing with a country that's gone through a coup? You know, that exhibits these kind of this sentiment of, you know, standing up to the West. What would be a rational response or a rational policy for managing that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I've leaned, you know, through this to, I lean toward the position of keep them at arm's length until the democratic climate really improves. I mean, if it improves, I think that, you know, I don't know, maybe this is still my own naivete, but I do think that there could be something like U.S. values in the world. I don't think we've achieved that, you know, but I think that there could be something like a consistent American approach to not working with countries that have, you know, horrendous human rights records and that have closed off political space. I mean, Mali really, you know, a very grim situation where just, you know, basic political and human rights have been completely violated. So I would take a break from these, you know, military relationships for a long time. I would not rush to recognize the results of the election in Chad. I would be very, very, you know, cautious about any future elections in, you know, held by the juntas in the other three Sahelian states. I would, you know, look for opportunities to work with, you know, the new president of Senegal, but also to give somebody like that some space, you know, and not immediately kind of, you know, demand that somebody like that, you know, hew to a kind of neoliberal line. Or I've been thinking about writing something about that. I think the counterargument to what I'm saying is that, you know, one could say, look, you know, you got to accept a certain amount of reality, and that the you know, the regimes in these countries are here to stay in one form or another, right? And the U.S. has to be pragmatic. To me, then I still wouldn't say, okay, rush out and embark on military partnerships with them. But I think one could say, okay, you know, what can the U.S. do on the non-military side to promote greater stability? There's a lot of people who are, you know, who are suffering tremendously, you know, displaced people, hungry people, and so forth. The U.S. has maintained a lot of life-saving humanitarian assistance. That's obviously crucial. I wish that the U.S. would get back to what I think of as, you know, old school sort of development, right? More than kind of intangible, amorphous things. You know, now development, I think a lot of the times means, you know, workshops and capacity building and things to promote civil society and these sort of like intangible, you know, trainings and things rather than build roads, build bridges, et cetera. I mean, people talked when Harris went to Ghana, people said, okay, fine, you know, Harris is here, you know, to tell the Ghanaians about how great the U.S. is, but she's traveling from the airport to Accra on a Chinese built road, you know? So it's like, build the roads, build the bridges, build the clinics, that's, I think, what I would advise. So yeah, I don't know. I lean toward, again, don't go too far in normalizing things with the juntas, but I think it'd be a powerful counterargument to say, look, you know, do you expect some form of these juntas to be around in 20 or 30 or not? I definitely would, right? And that's a lot of time to lose, half a decade of the relationship if you're trying to pressure them toward a democracy that they may never accept. So yeah, I don't know. I'm torn.
You wrote about this, and this will be you know, kind of where we leave off, but you brought up humanitarian projects, humanitarian programs are basically, you know, aid in that respect. And you wrote about this. There's some talk, and I think it's going to get louder if this happens in other places or the, you know, the longer we go with you know, the situation in Chad or with, you know, this back and forth in Niger, calls for the U.S. to punish the juntas by cutting aid to these countries, which seems entirely backwards. It's not going to punish the juntas. It's going to punish the people who you know, get help from these aid programs. But what do you say in response to those calls?
Yeah, I mean, I should say the person that I quoted, you know, or alluded to was furious with me over that and felt that I was being, you know, quite unfair because she had not called for the suspension of life-saving aid, but she had called for the suspension of you know, development aid. She had clarified that what she was mostly talking about were these sort of, you know, governance projects, countering violent extremism projects, etc. If the U.S. wants to cut that, I think they should, because those are in my mind useless anyways. You know, having workshops where you tell community leaders how to run their communities, like to me, all that is a joke to begin with, right? But I think if by development aid we mean, again, you know, concrete investments in, you know, in health, in, you know, infrastructure and things like that, then no, I don't think the U.S. should cut that. I mean, I think that even, you know, I think that should be maintained. And yeah, I think the military aid should be cut, but I would have said that before the coups anyway. So, I mean, I don't, because again, I don't think the training programs, and I don't think that was doing much good, any good really, and maybe even some harm to begin with. But yeah, I think if development means trying to make a concrete difference in people's lives, economically, infrastructurally, and so forth, then yeah, I do think that the U.S. should remain involved with that. And I don't think that would be rewarding the juntas to build a hospital, to build a, you know, and I think everybody agrees at a minimum that the direct sort of life-saving aid should be maintained. Hopefully there's a consensus on that. Yeah.
So I think we'll leave it there, Alex Thurston. Again, you know, guys, go pick up his book, go, you know, follow his Twitter feed, all of the good stuff. Alex, thanks again for coming. Read his columns at Foreign Exchanges, by the way. He's been writing those. He wrote one about Senegal not that long ago. Very good one. But Alex, thanks so much for coming back on the show, and we look forward to having you back.
Thanks a lot for having me on.